busy schedule this afternoon. I would say I hope it's going to be worthwhile, but I know it's going to be worthwhile. I've known Peter for a few years when Peter came to Denver, where I'm from, to work on Stapleton Airport, probably the largest redevelopment project in the United States, the redevelopment of the former Stapleton Airfield. Peter has had an illustrious career since his graduating from the Yale School of Architecture. In the mid-1970s, Peter worked with California Governor Jerry Brown. How's that for the Asia food? Yeah. On sustainable building projects and sustainable concepts, leading the profession into this area of inquiry. In 1983, he formed CalThorpe Associates, which has worked on several groundbreaking neighborhood development projects, including Laguna West, Sacramento County Plan, Stapleton Airport redevelopment in Denver, from coast to coast and overseas. A recent planning project was a massive Mesa del Sol project in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Peter's also been very engaged in the high-speed rail project in California. He is a visionary leader in the field of urban regional planning, beginning with the Blue Track and Vision 2040 projects for Portland metropolitan region. His firm, CalThorpe Associates, has worked on regional projects across the country, including Envision Utah for Salt Lake City region, Compass Vision for the Los Angeles, California area, and Louisiana Speaks for the state of Louisiana following the Katrina disaster. Currently, CalThorpe Associates is working on Vision California, helping that state develop a smarter land use plan to guide growth through the year 2050. Coincidentally, in this month's edition of Urban Land, the back page column is devoted to a discussion of Peter's travels that brings him here on his way to China to talk about this breaking down the scale of development as it occurs in China and its massive development of cities. He was named the 2006 laureate of the Urban Land Institute J.C. Nimbus Prize for Visionaries in Urban Development for his work in walkable communities and land preservation. He's co-authored several books on sustainable development, including The Pedestrian Pocketbook, The Next American Metropolis, Ecology, Community, and the American Dream, The Regional City, and most recently, Urbanism in the Age of Climate Change in 2010. So I think this afternoon's discussion will be very enlightening. I'll introduce Mayor Carlisle in a minute. Following Peter's presentation, I'll give you an update on the city's efforts in transit-oriented development and the activities that we've been undertaking over the past 4 years. So I think this will be a very interesting afternoon. Afterwards, we'll have a quick Q&A. So once again, thank you for your time and effort. And now at this time, I'd like to introduce Mayor Peter Carlisle.
When Terry was talking about Peter, he was talking about Peter CalThorpe, not Peter Carlisle, because apparently I didn't go to the Yale, School of Design or something like that, or have any of those other credentials. I'm your humble and beloved mayor. Many in Honolulu thought that we would never be able to build a rail line in our city, and it is being built now as we speak. Many felt that we would never secure federal funding for the project. It has now been guaranteed by Senator Inouye and has the enthusiastic support of all our delegation of congressional members. With the approval of heart by the electorate, politics happily have been marginalized in the progress of the city rail system. I was first introduced to the concept of TOD, or Transit-Oriented Development, when I was invited to participate in the Mayor's Institute of City Design session in Santa Fe, New Mexico, in February 2011. A case study had been prepared with the help of Terry for presentation during the session regarding Honolulu's planned 20-mile elevated rail and the opportunities for new transit-oriented development around the transit stops. The case study from Honolulu regarded the proposed Kapalama rail station and was presented by myself at the Institute. I and six other mayors from various jurisdictions across the country, from Syracuse, New York to Tacoma, Washington, were grilled mercilessly and humbled by a panel of national and internationally credentialed experts. As a result, I learned about the complexities and opportunities that come with transit and transit-oriented development. My education has continued with now weekly meetings with Terry, who is gifted, capable, and also nationally recognized for his work on TOD. I begrudgingly admit that we are incredibly lucky to have him as a member of the city team. He is putting together an infrastructure symposium for this fall to further our progress on transit-oriented development. Finally, I was also given a chance to meet with Peter Calthorpe a couple of months ago. I was astounded by his knowledge and expertise, so I asked him to come here and share it with you. Mr. Calthorpe. Yeah.
Future of the island, they're about how people are going to live, what opportunities people have, how healthy they are, and how healthy the environment is. Urban design, which is deeply linked to transit, and inseparable, really. The kind of transportation system we choose really determines the kind of communities we build. Since World War II, we invested heavily in highways, and we subsidized automobiles and single-family dwellings, and hence we got suburban sprawl. Now, that worked for a long time for a lot of people, especially after World War II. We were the richest and, quite frankly, the only middle class on the planet. That's no longer the case. And the economic crunch we find ourselves in, I don't think is just about jobs or about investments. It's about the kind of lifestyles we are going to be able to lead in the future. Now, I don't think this is a hair shirt. I think this is a huge opportunity to configure our communities around who we really are. After World War II, we were families with kids. This was what was happening in a big, big way. Over 50% of households were couples with their children. And the whole model of, you know, free-flowing freeways and distant suburbs with large yards really worked. And we had the money to pay for it, and the environmental consequences hadn't surfaced. Fast forward 50 years and we're in a different situation. Only 23% of our households now are families with kids. We are a different people with different needs, economically and environmentally. We know now that the freeways are no longer free-flowing, and no matter what we do, they're not going to be free-flowing. We need choices and alternatives. We know now that the environment is fragile and is being damaged. And we can have a big debate about climate change, but I'm one who believes that it's definitely happening, and we need to take responsibility for that and find lifestyles that aren't going to burden the planet quite so much. So when I talk about urbanism and climate change, I'm talking about a big shift in the way we live and the kind of communities we build. And I think it's a shift towards a better lifestyle, a healthier lifestyle, a more affordable lifestyle. So this is, just to take the really big picture for a minute, a map, and you can't see the numbers, unfortunately, but on the left side there is 1960, and on the right is 2005. This is the ecological footprint of mankind on the planet. In that period, from 1960 to 2005, the global population doubled. But you'll note that a lot of our footprints, cropland, which is green at the bottom, grazing land, forest, fishing, and even built-up land, which you can barely see in there, it's that bright blue line, it's not that much. Those are the environmental demands we're putting on the planet, and remain constant. That meant that all those features, at a global scale, doubled in efficiency, because they're supplying twice the population. The thing, of course, that changed was energy and carbon release. And you can see that in the yellow line. It's translated into the number of acres it would take to absorb the carbon output by forest. So it is a measure of the ecological footprint of our carbon output. Now, the astounding thing about this graph is you can see that red line. That's the capacity of the Earth. So something startling happened in many of our lifetimes. We, for the first time in human history, crossed the line in terms of putting a greater burden on the planet than it can handle. And I think that's the larger context that everybody has to keep in the back of their heads. We all act from immediate needs and immediate capacities. But there has to be a larger sensibility about the long-term well-being of all of us and everything. So let me bring it down to earth. Whoops, what happened here? Let me bring it down to earth in where I live, the Bay Area. A lot of people think Americans are wedded to the automobile. There's no changing that, and it's a great thing because it gives us freedom of choice and mobility. Well, the mobility is there sometimes and sometimes not. You know that here. I believe this city, this island, has the worst congestion in the United States. You have something like 58 hours of congestion on average that everybody sits in for a year. And that's because of the urban form you have, which is a linear high-density city. It's a perfect form for transit, and it's the complete nightmare for automobiles, because it means that all the automobiles are traveling in the same corridor at the same time. Places like Denver, where they're spread out in all directions, are able to disperse traffic in many directions. And you know, they still end up congested. Nonetheless, we haven't solved that problem. But here it's particularly aggravated. And there's really no easy solution to it because you're in a very confined corridor. There's not a lot of room for a new freeway. So that is one issue that has to be held in place. But we do tend to think that it's been that way in the past and it can be that way in the future. It's not that way. It's all about where you live. So here's a cross-section of the Bay Area, and each one of those colors represents a different average auto use per year per household. And you can bet the orange is up around 30,000 miles a year. And the dark green, which actually includes not just San Francisco, but where I live in Berkeley and Oakland, can be down around 7,000. There's a 3-to-1 variation in auto use based on where you live, how walkable it is, how close to transit it is. Not all Americans are the same. There's a huge variety, and people like the variety. They like to be able to choose. And what we're for is providing more choices. And I think that's what rail and transit-oriented development will do for the island. It will provide another choice rather than just more of the same. More highways, more subdivisions. So here is three places, a kind of cross-section across the Bay Area. San Ramon is the outer orange, 30,000 VMT suburban sprawl. If you can see the map there, you get it. It's a freeway interchange, subdivisions, office parks, and malls. There's not a place on there that you can get to that you have to have a car for, that you don't have to have a car for. Everything is auto-oriented. You really have no choice. I find it fascinating that many people who criticize our efforts to at least provide the option of transit say that somehow we're taking away choice when we've been building environments that have really extracted choice. America used to be very diverse. We had great downtowns. We had streetcar suburbs, which leads me to the second place, Rockridge. Now, Rockridge is a neighborhood on the outskirts of Oakland that used to be on the Red Line, the old streetcar that got torn up after World War II in the Bay Area, just like the streetcars were torn up all across the United States. It was a walkable neighborhood that was served by transit. Streetcar suburbs were a great middle ground. It didn't mean that everybody had to live in the urban center. They could have single-family dwellings. Typically, they were smaller bungalows. But they had walkable environments. They had real choices. The third, of course, is San Francisco, the denser grid. But San Francisco is not a particularly dense city. As a matter of fact, it's not nearly as dense as Honolulu. So what does it look like? Here's the different characters. San Francisco is largely a three-story residential fabric, but pretty dense. Notice Rockridge here in the lower corner there. Those are the traditional starter homes, the affordable first rung on the ladder for many people in America to get that home ownership. Small lot, but the trade-off was you didn't have a big yard, but you had good parks nearby and you could walk to stores and services. And then, of course, San Ramon, a landscape dominated by garage doors and parking lot. When it comes to shopping, we all know the differences. There's the mall, which is approachable only in a car. And then, it's interesting, San Francisco and Rockridge have very similar main streets. Wonderful walkable streets that that are connected to the neighborhoods and also connect you to transit opportunities. And then jobs, the whole issue of where people go to work. There's the great downtown, it's an intense urban center in San Francisco, a lot of vitality. But in Rockridge, that low-scale mixed use begins to point the way to a kind of future for America that I think is very, very healthy, where you can go to work without your car and still walk midday to a good restaurant and run your errands. San Ramon up there is the office park. You really have to drive. Even if the bus ran there, you'd be stranded if you got there without it. Now, here are the numbers for those three places. You can do it this way. No, it's too small. Urban is San Francisco. Compact is Rockridge, which is the new kind of reborn. I forgot to mention, Rockridge was a streetcar suburb. It got reborn as a TOD because it got a BART station. Elevated track, exactly what you're thinking of here. And quite frankly, if you visit Rockridge, you'll note that that elevated track doesn't disrupt the pedestrian movement and actually doesn't harm the quality of that neighborhood. As a matter of fact, it's one of the most desirable in the East Bay. So that's Compact, and then Sprawl is, of course, San Ramon. So notice the annual carbon emissions goes from 6 to 21. There's that 3.5 to 1 ratio. Big differences. But you'll notice that nice kind of a mid-scale works very, very well, and it's something that I think is very important to our future. Land consumption, for 100 units of housing, it takes 2 acres in San Francisco, average 50 units an acre. It takes 7, still very compact. But that's an environment that's a mix of single family and apartment buildings, low-rise apartment buildings. And then, of course, once you get out into the world of subdivisions, it's on the order of 30 acres. So at the most basic level, in terms of environmental concerns and conservation, land consumption is the name of the game on that level. The walk score, how many of you knew what that is? Does the walk score work here? Okay, so just go online, look it up, it's very cool. You put in your address, it'll tell you whether you're in a walkable neighborhood or not by proximity to lots of local destinations. San Francisco, of course, is top, 100 is perfect. Rockridge is really good, and I don't know why San Ramon got 46%. It's probably because they've measured it by as the crow flies, not as you walk. But here is the real kicker in this. Because we tend to say that the marketplace demands large lot single family subdivisions. That's what the American dream is. That's where the money goes. The reality is quite different. When you look at the value per square foot, and all three of these places are high end, so they are apples to apples comparison. The San Francisco neighborhood we chose, you got a house there, you paid $550 a square foot, and you didn't get any yard. In Rockridge, you pay $420 a square foot, and you get a tiny yard, but you get all those other amenities. And the market tells us that the large lot with the big yard is only worth $320 a square foot. So the value of this, the value of urbanism is clearly expressed in these numbers. Now, a lot of people say this is a problem because it means that urbanism costs too much for many, many people. That's just because there's a dearth. If we had more of it, if we had more Rockridges, if we had more transit-oriented development, if you build your line and build communities around it, you have the ability here to build enough so that you won't drive the affordable end of the spectrum off the page. I already mentioned this statistic, but it's just startling to most people. We have this mental image that America is mom and dad and a couple kids and a couple cars in the suburbs. It's just not who we are anymore. The largest single group now are people who live alone, single people. I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, but that's the reality. And of course, what's coming next? In the next 2 decades, we have empty nesters, all of us baby boomers who are without kids, and therefore don't need to be way out there in that school district and or with that big yard. And we have Gen Y who actually prefer to not own a car at all and love the idea of living in urban environments. And then in between there, you have a lot of people who just need some economic choices because that lifestyle of the suburbs doesn't fit. And this is why. This shows you The median income in the United States is $50,000, $48,000, I think, now. It's falling slightly. That's the median income. Typically around half, if you're lucky, half of that, this is the 800-pound gorilla in the room, half of that goes to your mortgage, rent, and the cost of transportation. Owning the cars, insuring them, maintaining them, paying for the gas. Those two things are 50% of everybody's budget. So if you look at it that way, $25,000, what happens? The red here is the housing cost, and the green is transportation. If you own three cars, on average, you're spending $14,000 a year on transportation. That's the national averages. You're spending more on transportation if you're driving that distance than you are on your house. And this is partly why the real estate industry collapsed, because people couldn't afford paying both the mortgage on the big lot house, the large lot home, and the transportation cost. You jump down to two cars, and you started to get in balance. But look what happens. If you live in a place where you only have to own one car, all of a sudden you're rich. You can afford a whole other set of options in terms of housing and or other things that you may want. And then if you're Gen Y, you love to live in a city without a car, you use Zip Car and you use transit, and you have and you're even richer in terms of housing. That's a big deal. Now, a lot of people said, well, this is all a nice theory, but the reality in America is it doesn't work. Show us how it works, show us where it works. Now, I was lucky enough to, I think you mentioned, done the project in Portland in 1989. We were asked by an environmental group, 1,000 Friends of Oregon, who put in place the legislation that put an urban growth boundary. The point of the urban growth boundary was to preserve ag and forest land. It wasn't to change urban form inside the line. But there was a little kicker in the law that said that every 5 years they had to figure out how much land they needed for growth. And that made them stop and think about whether they were going to grow up or they were going to grow out. On top of that, the feds came in and said, we're going to build a new highway right through here, right through this beautiful valley. And they had billions of dollars stored up to build this new freeway. Because the traffic engineers, they love these ring roads. You can't do them here, but that's what they do everywhere else. They put the circle template and they draw it. That's what I see in China everywhere. It's ring road after ring road after ring road. It's obscene. 1,000 Friends in Oregon and us came in and said, well, what if you took that money and you built the West Side Light Rail Line and you lined it with transit-oriented development? And they won the day, short story. It got adopted by Metro. And then here's the data, which is kind of astounding. By 96, which is where these lines cross, this line is VMT per capita in Portland, and the red line is the average VMT per capita for the country. Now, for the country, the VMT, over long periods of time, is constantly rising. We're driving more and more because we spread out more and more, and we have less viable alternatives. But in Portland, because they chose to build TOD and transit, the VMT has been falling. It's been falling ever since 96. It is down 11% overall. Now, that 11% sounds like, oh, that's just at the margin. That's a big, big number in terms of lots of things, air quality, congestion, all sorts of things. And so don't let anybody tell you that this is an unproven theory. It's logical. The computer model's validated. And now we have a living laboratory that shows how it works. And you can go there and you can experience both the transit and the transit-oriented development. We're doing the same thing in California now. We passed the law because of climate change, because we wanted to meet the Kyoto targets. We said we're also going to reduce our dependence on automobiles, a radical thing for California. And we set targets for each of the regions. And Los Angeles has met its target with its future plans by building more transit and more transit-oriented development. Their target was to reduce VMT by 15% by the year 2035, and they're doing it. And they're doing it based on a network, an expanding network. And by the way, just like you, they voted in a sales tax increase in 08. They're going to spend $40 billion on expanding transit, and they just got a new kicker of an extra couple billion from the high-speed rail guys just last week to upgrade their transit systems. Over 50% of housing, well, close to 50% of housing and over 50% of jobs will be within walking distance of their transit. So from the automobile city to the transit city, it's happening everywhere. And it's necessary everywhere. So here you are on this island, a million people, and I know that there's a lot of arm wrestling about whether this is a good thing or not, but I come in, you know, from outside, and I gotta say, this is a no-brainer. I mean, this is the most perfect city for transit I've ever seen, because of the matter I mentioned before, the linear quality, the higher density. And then when we look more closely at it, the numbers really add up. You know, you have here, it is a microcosm. All the issues that everybody else faces, you face here. Since 92, you have paved and developed 10 square miles of your island. The question is, what are you going to do in the next 40? You can fantasize about stopping growth and building fences and saying nobody else gets to live here and people can't have babies. Or you can plan intelligently and actually use that growth to improve existing neighborhoods and create choices that people didn't have in the past. But you have the worst congestion. You have some of the, you know, clearly the highest electric cost of any place in the United States. Everything, all the oil is imported. It's your only energy source. You don't have a diverse energy source. And you have a real affordability issue. And I think that the transit system can begin to address all those issues simultaneously. And of course, it has to do with how you want the whole island to develop. What it really boils down to is if you build this infrastructure, you can gather around it like a magnet pulling in filing all the development. You can preserve the North Shore. You can prevent kind of random sprawl throughout the island and literally orchestrate a much healthier and environmental future for the island. So you've all seen the maps. It's really quite extraordinary. We've been studying this and looking about it. And the foundation, of course, of any study is, well, is scenarios. We don't tend to just say, okay, this is the future, what are the numbers? We say, well, there could be four or five different futures. Let's look at all five or four and compare them. And then you choose. And so that's kind of what we've been at. The foundation, of course, is how much you're going to grow, how much the rail corridor can handle, and what type of growth would be there. How much? I know everybody debates these numbers, but the reality is growth is happening. And it's healthier to accommodate it in a positive way than to believe that you can just stop it, because it doesn't just stop. And I guess we can go on and on, and we can end the discussion here. But the state projections here are for about 189,000 new population by the year 2050. By the way, this is a very slow growth rate compared to many places in the United States. This is not an intense growth rate at all. So think of it simply as 100,000 units of housing. That's what you get to deal with over the next 4 years. And it turns out that when you study this rail line, and the red areas here are infill and redevelopable land, and the green areas are open space within walking distance, within either a half mile or a mile of the transit system. So within a half mile, with the extensions, you have over 5,000 acres of capacity on the line. You can easily accommodate 80, 90% of the growth. You'll never get 100%. There's always going to be one or two things happening here and there. But you can handle a very high percentage of your growth on this corridor. In LA, as we pointed out, we felt we were lucky to get to 43% of new households within walking distance of transit. You could have 80% easily with your eyes shut. And it wouldn't be that everybody would have to live in a condo. There are areas that would work very nicely, a la Rock Ridge, to create walkable neighborhoods with bungalows and townhouses and low-rise apartments. So you can put all of the above, a whole range of things. And everybody says, well, that's going to force people away from what they really want. Well, what you want and what you want in the environment of trade-offs are two different things. Everybody wants a yacht, but not everybody can afford a yacht. And quite frankly, when they really stop and think about it, yeah, I want a yacht, but then, well, maybe I don't want the upkeep, and I guess I wouldn't use it that much, and da 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 da, and all of a sudden, I don't really need a yacht. And that's a little bit the same mentality around the single family. If single family is the only choice, then yeah, that's what you're going to choose. But if there are really good alternatives, if you could choose a small lot within walking distance, or even a townhouse, which isn't typical on an island, but I think can and should be. And then you think about the affordability issue and the demographics, all of a sudden these things begin to make sense. Here's some of the surveys. 50% said they would actually prefer to live in a place within walking distance of transit. So, what do the numbers show us? In terms of market demand for housing going forward, it's negative on large lot. That's because us empty nesters are going to have a hard time maintaining those big places, both utilities and all sorts of things. It no longer fits our lifestyle. What's needed is multifamily, single family attached, and small lot. Those are the things, and those are all good things for TOD. Let me give you some pictures quickly. So the infill stuff you do, we've done. This is Oakland. But the point is that this kind of growth can repair damaged places. So here in downtown Oakland, a big open parking lot, a very dangerous part of the city, redeveloped into housing, all of a sudden becomes a vital neighborhood. In San Jose, on the left, that was an old industrial area with a rail line running through it. And now it's been redeveloped once again into a mix of apartments and single family. And it looks like this. So it starts in the upper left-hand corner as old industrial warehouses and becomes a resource, a repaired, healthy neighborhood. So it's not just about transit and, you know, and ridership. It's also about repairing existing developed areas, which is a big environmental positive. Stapleton was mentioned, and it's a good example of the kinds of development that's very desirable and can be very much transitory. It's the rebirth of the streetcar suburb. And in it, you have a whole range of housing types. One of the things I love about Stapleton is if you go diagonal there, on the lower right-hand corner, you have the highest cost house in the Denver region back then was about $1.8 million. That's what that house sold for. Three blocks away were these bungalows, and they were selling for around $200,000. So you had a 10-to-1 economic spread in the same neighborhood. This whole idea of economic segregation, I think, is way past its prime. And places like Sacramento that mix affordable housing with high-end housing, with townhouses, the whole range of housing types, really are exciting and vital, and they maintain high value. Why? Because they have all sorts of community assets within walking distance. And this is some pictures of some of those features there. But it's a walkable fabric that makes it special and makes it desirable. Okay, so the study is not complete. I'm going to show you some early results, but it's framed this way, which is there are four futures. Business as usual, no rail. You just keep growing, it, just like you did from 92 to 05, you know, just projects here and there around the island. The future forecast changes that because it recognizes that the demand for large lot single family is waning and a higher density development pattern will emerge, and it has rail, but it's not really focused on the core. The fourth one is very much what you guys are developing here, which is really focused on TOD and rail, and the third one, station area. And then the corridor focus kind of says, well, what if you really went all in? You kind of pushed all your chips into the center of the pile and said, okay, we're doing this and largely that. That's 85% of growth in the corridor. And so we compare those, and you hear the numbers. And this is maybe the simplest way to think about it. These are different development types. Red is high density, transit oriented, is the infill stuff. The orange is Rock Ridge, middle kind of scale, walkable, Stapleton. And the light is the, of course, subdivisions out there where only cars can go. And A is business as usual. B, the forecast actually shifts in a healthy direction, but not quite as focused around transit. C is where you're headed with your plans, and we think a very healthy direction. And D is even more intense. So what are the big differences? The biggest difference is land consumption, and it's really quite startling. So if you take a look at the far column there, 2010 to 2050, 40 years, Business as usual, 21 square miles. You developed twice as much land as you developed over the last, since 92, the last 10 years. The future forecast brings it down. The stationary plan cuts it in half. 10 square miles, 6,000 acres of development eliminated from the island. That's a big, big deal. Forget about transportation. But you can't do that without alternative transportation systems. And then, of course, even more intense is the corridor focus. So these are just the numbers you choose. Now, here's what's most fascinating. For that increment of 100,000 units, the average driving per household is near 13,000 with business as usual. Right now, the average VMT for the island is 14,000. It's not bad, actually. You know, it's because it's not a huge area, and a lot of people do live close to the city. So you're actually better than the national norm. But look how much better you get all the way down here at C or D. When you go down to C, you've cut the average automobile dependence in half. That's not eliminating the car. It's not eliminating choice. It's not eliminating freedom. It's just saying that people have enough choices that they don't always have to use their car. Well, what is that translating to? Vehicle miles traveled. If you add it all up, and this is all in, the increment and the existing population, the difference in terms of the total VMT driven is the equivalent of taking, say, under scenario C, 160,000 cars off the road. That's how much driving you're eliminating. Now, you can think of all the implications of that. I know air quality is not an issue here. You've got your trade winds just cleaning you off all the time. But all those other issues from climate change on down are related to that, and cost. And I'll get into the cost side a little more. Fuel consumption. There's a 14 to 17% reduction in fuel consumption. That's money in people's pockets. That actually represents around $10 billion in passenger. I think there's the numbers. So when people say, let's not build transit, we'll save money, it's an illusion. You will spend the money. You'll just spend more in other places. So the average citizen will be, collectively, you will have spent $10 billion more on burning additional fuel. And because of all those additional vehicle miles, you will have to build more highways. There's no getting away from it. I mean, if you put that many more miles, that many more cars on roads, just proportion out, just to stay where you are, which is not a good place, you're going to have to build, what was the number here? 230 lane miles, just to stay even with where you are, if you don't begin to wean yourselves and give people a choice in another direction. So that's another $10 billion. So $10 billion in more highways, and by the way, they probably are going to be elevated, because I don't see a lot of open space to build a highway anywhere near this city. So there's an elevated structure for $10 billion overall. And the fuel costs, another $10 billion. So you're up to $20 billion of costs, and people are worried about spending $5 billion on this transit system. So I look at this, I see it all over the United States, false choices. People think, if we just do nothing, we'll save money. The reality is, doing nothing has all sorts of unintended, but in clear view, consequences. And if you don't build transit, you're going to have people driving more. And if you're going to have people driving more, you're going to have to spend more on roads. It's simple. It doesn't take a rocket science or a doctorate. I don't have a doctorate. I'm very depressed about that. What does that $10 billion buy you of roads, buy you in terms of transit? 39 miles of transit. So, there is no nothing option. It's always something. And that's what I find very interesting about the political discourse in America, especially now as we're in this recession and everybody's trying to pull back and saying, we can't spend money, we can't do anything, we've got to stop doing everything. The reality is stopping costs money. We had the same debate over high-speed rail. People said it's too expensive, $68 billion to build high-speed rail. The alternative, you're just taking the trips from LA to San Francisco and the number of them that are going to go by plane and the number that will go by car, and building enough road capacity for the road trips and enough airport capacity for the airplanes, $178 billion of airport expansion and highway expansion to achieve the same goal. But of course, the political dialogue wasn't framed that way. It was, we can't afford this, you know, extravagance. The truth is, we can't afford to not build it. And I would say the same is true here. Oh, I'm supposed to be impartial. You have four choices. You can write down your selection at the end of this talk. And don't let me bias you. Okay, there's more. Actually, when you build more compact and smaller bungalows, there's a smaller energy bill. It's obvious, right? Single-story buildings with big roofs consume a lot more energy. We can put a number to that. And it's equivalent to 65,000 homes in terms of energy. Water use goes down. Less yards to irrigate, less parking lots to take care of, et cetera, et cetera. Roadway costs, this is the $10 billion, or $9.2 billion for major roads. Now that doesn't include local roads. So just think about it. If you're building either 20 square miles of development over the next 40 years, or you're building 7 or 10, there's a lot less asphalt roads and infrastructure embedded inside that. Forget about the regional highway and arterials, just the local stuff. So there's a huge saving there that gets rolled into this. That's the major. Here it is when you add the highway arterials and the local infrastructure. So you're talking about lots of money here. And the main issue is just to remember that it's a choice, not an absolute. So the difference here for the cumulative cost is somewhere between $7 and $10 billion for infrastructure. Now, this all amounts sooner or later. Everything goes back to the average person's pocketbook. Whether it's through taxes or direct purchase, I don't care. Sooner or later, somebody pays, right? I mean, that's the nature of reality. And so the cost trickles down into the house. And if we build these more efficient communities, people use their car less, they save money there, they have more compact, energy-efficient homes, they save money there. Lo and behold, you're somewhere between $5,000 and $7,000 a year richer, which for many households is a very big, important number. And it means, you know, will make a huge difference in people's life choices here. Finally, the greenhouse gas emissions. You know, I think that we're crazy to be ignoring this nationally. We've shown in California that with our new state AB 32 law, we can meet the Kyoto target without compromising our lifestyles. Actually, by enhancing our communities and beginning to shift into the kinds of technologies that are dominant. I'm not going to get into my whole rap about that. We'll leave that aside, but something I'm particularly passionate about. Here, the difference in greenhouse gas emissions would be equal to about 168,000 acres of land here, in terms of uptake. I can't remember. Oh yeah, there it is. That's 44% of the island. So, that's my conclusion. I've tried to be totally unbiased, as you can see. Neutral, just delivering the facts. Believe me, the models have been examined by cynics up and down. You can imagine that certain people really think this is erroneous, and so the kind of peer review that's gone through for the state of California. This model originated in order to monitor the state's compliance with its goals vis-a-vis AB 32 and SB 375, which are laws that have to do with carbon and vehicle reduction. It's in the public domain. It's been vetted because, of course, there are many people who don't like the results. So I think it's rock solid. I think these numbers are obvious, quite frankly, when you stop and think about the not so unintended consequences of doing nothing. And so I leave you with that you have both global well-being and local well-being in your hands with this decision. And I think it should be an easy decision. Thank you.
Chance for someone of Peter's caliber to come to the island very often, and so I was going to follow up here with a brief presentation about what we've been doing in the 3 years and longer before I've been here. And it's certainly not just been me. David Tenoy, the planning director, Kathy Sokogawa, the head of the planning division, Bonnie Arakawa, the head of community planning, the people at HART, the people at in Wayne Yoshioka's shop. There's been a real team effort going on in the city for many years. Prior to me getting in. We've been doing a lot. You can go to our website, honolulu.dpp.org, if you'd like to see the many plans of the 21 stations along the route. We have plans for, I believe at this point, about 17 of them. We've had 50 community meetings, major symposiums across the city. We've been doing physical analysis, economic analysis, working with community groups. We've done community surveys. We've done a lot of work. August 7th, we're going to have a meeting on Ala Moana at McKinley High School at 6 p.m. for those of you who live in the Ala Moana neighborhood area. I'm saying this because what I'd rather do is have the audience have the opportunity to ask Peter some questions at this time. Me, I'll be here every day, more or less. Peter will only be here today and perhaps some point in the future. So at this point, I'd rather ask if there are questions in the audience that people would like to ask and then have Peter answer them.
Thank you, Peter, for your presentation. I had one comment, perhaps a slight correction. You said we have the highest electric cost. We don't. We're 10th highest electric cost. Highest rates, low use. I didn't turn my furnace on one time all last winter.
Oh, highest rates. You're right.
But not highest cost, because we don't heat and we don't universally air condition.
Yeah.
So, but that's we don't even understand that sometimes. My other question, though, is how do we finance TOD in an area where property taxes are so low that property tax increment financing, TIF, won't work here? We need some other methodology, either all tax TIF, like Albuquerque has, you may be familiar with that project, or some other method of paying the helping the developer put in the infrastructure.
Let me actually make one modification of that. It's not our property taxes that are the problem relative to TIF, it's the fact that our property values are so high that the escalation from development is fairly low, but at any rate.
And I'm going to let you answer that question because I don't have the local knowledge to get at that.
Financing infrastructure, as you're well aware, we've had this conversation, is a major concern. And as the mayor mentioned very early on in his introduction, we are in the process of trying to do an infrastructure symposium in the near future because we have to manage and challenge this issue. Part of it is historically, at least in my opinion, the way that we finance infrastructure is on the backs of new development. People complain about new development, but over the many decades, not years, but decades, in this community, you financed it on the back of new development. Now you want to say no new development, and the infrastructure is falling apart. So we've got to come up with a new paradigm and dramatically shift the way that we finance infrastructure, and we are working on that.
And I will add something, which is that, once again, it's the no-choice option still has costs. So, you know, if you spread the development over 20 square miles across the island, there's still infrastructure to be financed. You're still left with the same problem. Actually, you're left with twice the problem in terms of infrastructure cost.
Other questions? Anyone in the audience, please raise your hand. Yes.
Thanks, Peter. I have a question related to how you communicate to the public the need to develop around these transit stops, transit facilities, rather than just pave parking lots around them. I had a conversation with a friend the other night who said he wasn't in favor of rail because he couldn't see how he was going to get down from a suburban household up in one of the valleys to be able to drive to the transit stop, park, and then use the rail, because he didn't see that there were going to be parking lots.
Yeah, that's a very tricky question. And the reality is, because the good news is this system can carry so much walk-in traffic because of its proximity to existing high-density development, because its ability to draw in future growth within walking distance, that it'll have a very high ridership without the drive-in. The drive-in is a big dilemma, and typically it's a very precise analysis calculation. Not every station gets park and ride. It's only certain stations get park and ride. And the reality, of course, is that there are many people that don't use this system. It's not a system that is universal. And so, you know, not everybody can get at it. And, you know, the way I see it, you know, the people who aren't living on it are coming from the hills, and they're coming down equally. So by the time they get to transit, it's probably not that different than if they go direct to their destination. So the reality is that it's going to benefit the island by keeping more of that sprawl from happening. And by, for people who are now in the corridor, traveling by car along the corridor, they begin to have an option. And then there's a selective capacity for park and ride. Now, feeder buses are also a big part of the equation, and that's a bigger lift. People are less comfortable taking, you know, a transfer, but it's certainly something that's there for people that economically say, well, shoot, if I do it that way, I can have one less car at home. I've got another $7,000 to play around with. So there's many answers to the questions, and it's not one particular size fits all. The easy answer is park and ride. There will be some of that in selected locations. Now, of course, what's happening with BART over time, our transit system started with all park and ride and has now evolved away from it. And they build parking structures for park and ride to maintain that capacity, and they develop sites simultaneously. That evolves into place over time with property values. And part of the design, the complexity of the design, and I'm sure you're getting at with your Todd planning, is, you know, there's phasing, and it starts with this, and it changes over time.
Questions?
Thank you. One of the concerns people have is just light rail compared to other types of rail that might be more affordable. Have you looked at the cost benefits of trying a different type of rail? And if you could explain to us what you found.
Well, we haven't studied it in detail, but I've done enough of this kind of work to know what's going on. First of all, your levels of congestion in your city are extreme. And in some suburban locations, like when we ran the West Side Light Rail line out of Portland, we were running through suburban areas that had very low congestion levels. So we could afford to capture right-of-way and take lanes away from existing arterials. You can't afford to do that here. That's the number one. So if you try to do at grade, whether it's BRT or light rail, you're going to have a real struggle finding the space, literally the space. And then you'd have all the arm wrestling about, oh, you're going to take away my parking, or you're going to take away a lane of traffic where it's already congested. Then you double up on that, which is both of those systems are lower capacity. Because of the density and the linear quality of the city, you're going to have a very high ridership, which means a very efficient, cost-effective system. But a high ridership needs a high capacity system. Light rail doesn't get you there, and BRT does not get you there. You know, at the very least, you're going to end up at around 130,000 passengers a day. And under some of the scenarios we're looking at, it could be way north of that. And so a BART-like system is what's most appropriate in terms of capacity. So the two issues around alternative systems are spatial. Where do you put it? If you put it at grade, not only are you stealing, making things worse congestion-wise, but the system itself is not running that well. Even if you have timed signals, you know, the trigger in the, hypothetically, the train moves right through smoothly, never happens that way, and there's delay at intersections, and you're causing delay to the traffic in the orthogonal direction, so you get into a whole mess that way. and the system runs slower. So it has lower capacity, runs slower. If it runs slower, it's less attractive to riders, and you get a cascading problem. So from my standpoint, knowing all these different systems, in many places I recommend light rail because the volumes are low and you're running in areas that have the spatial capacity for that. But not here. Wouldn't work.
Hi, Peter. I'm Kevin Carney with EAH Housing, and we support TOD development, and we've done one in Northern California. Do your studies, it's my understanding that studies show that the average rail rider, the majority of rail riders, their incomes are at about 50% of the area median income and below. And I just wanted to find out if that's what the studies that you've seen have shown. And if so, then that tells me that this ridership is looking mostly for, or can only afford rental property and not to purchase, particularly with the high cost of housing in Honolulu. So my next question is, do you have any silver bullets to bridge the gap in providing subsidies to build that affordable rental housing?
Well, certainly in mature areas like the Bay Area, you have very high-end housing, you know, being attracted to transit locations. So it's not true that it's only low income. It's very much about, you know, origins, specific destinations. That said, there's no question that overall, if you took the national norm, transit riders are lower income. They're taking advantage because they need to take advantage of a cheaper way of getting around. So that's kind of a fundamental reality. There's a lot of people here that would enjoy that opportunity. Now, inclusionary zoning within the TOD is a very important thing, and that there needs to be enough affordable housing embedded inside the TOD. So counterintuitive to what you're saying, which is you'd think naturally all the TODs would be low income. Actually, because they create such an accessibility advantage, they can tend in the other direction and become gentrification. So the part of the issue is, how do you subsidize that affordable housing? There are many mechanisms. It's an issue that, you know, we can't unwrap right here, right now, that easily. I will say that when you think about affordable lifestyles instead of affordable housing, starting at a transit location is a natural advantage. You create a more affordable lifestyle because there's less burden on that household in their transportation pocketbook. So, very complex question. The reality, of course, is that all these things can be solved because we see the solutions, good examples of solutions all around.
One last question.
Have you seen benefits?
Where's the question? Who's talking? Oh,
I'm sorry. Have you seen...
Stand up and be heard.
Have you seen any benefits nationally, land use benefits from rail streetcar systems that supplement the higher capacity systems, streetcar systems that may replace major bus service and attract higher clientele and have land use benefits?
Yeah. Well, of course, streetcars are a sexy version of buses. And the only real advantage is that they, because the tracks are there and the alignment can't move, they stabilize real estate values. So, for example, in Portland, they built their new streetcar, and it was largely had a huge impact on real estate values and housing densities. It evolved a really wonderful neighborhood that was linked into the downtown and the larger regional light rail system. So that hierarchy is good. Sometimes it could be streetcars, and that actually reinforces increased property values. Sometimes it can be buses, sometimes it can be BRT. It's a very place-specific design exercise. In Portland, it's mixed flow, so the lanes are not dedicated to the streetcars, and traditionally that's the way streetcars are. So they only work for short distances because their travel speeds are about the same as being in a car. The advantage is you don't have a car when you get there. You don't have the cost of parking it and finding a parking place and all the rest of that, which of course is a big deal in many environments. So I'm a guy who's for all of the above when it comes to transit. I think that you need a whole hierarchy of systems, all coordinated and feeding into each other. One of the things we don't have in the Bay Area is a coordinated ticketing system. So you have these different transit agencies doing different things. And it should be one ticket for all, everywhere, seamless. And of course, the timing of the intersections are also very important. But once you get started, you need the backbone system. I mean, we have BART, and then everything kind of radiates off BART. You need this backbone system, and then all the other things can feed into it. And the park and ride problem, over time, evolves into a bus and ride phenomenon, or a bike and ride phenomenon, if you have an expanding bike network, which is also a very healthy thing. So my attitude is yes to all of the above, except new highways.
Sadly, the campaign trail calls me. I've got to go out and have an interview with the union. So, and Wayne's coming with me on that. I don't know if you know that. Are you on the way with me on that? So, I've got to hit the road, but please don't let me stop you speaking to Peter if you want to, and if Peter, you've got some more time. I was happy to hear that he's going to be here till tomorrow morning. He's going to get out and take a night dip because he likes being in the ocean at night. I'm asking him to be
slightly... We take it for granted.
Yeah, we take it for granted. And, too, he also said that, you know, he feels better while he's here and sort of... coaxed me to the idea that he might actually even think of moving here at some point.
I know you don't want people from the mainland.
I would personally love to see you here for as long as you would like to be. To have the High Chief of Transit Orient Development amongst us is a great pleasure and a privilege. So I want to thank you for taking me up on the invitation. I've always enjoyed speaking with you and listening to you speak. So let's give one more great big hand.
Thank you, Peter Carlisle. Thank you, Peter Calthorpe. And thank you for your time and participation. Please stay engaged. Please get your neighbors involved and engaged. And you stay engaged. Thank you once again for your time. Good evening.